Welcome to Season 3 of the Student Christian Movement Podcast. SCM is a community of students, past and present, and we hope to be a generous community expressing a lived faith in Jesus Christ where social action meets prayerful devotion. We seek to be both a radical voice for equality and justice, as well as a safe home for progressive Christian students. In Season 3 of the SCM podcast, we will be exploring Christian political action, including everything from voting and democracy to trade unions and political organising. With over 4 billion people expected to vote this year, it is a massive year for democracy and politics globally. We want to equip students with the tools that they need to be able to engage with politics on a local level, a national level, in their communities and their workplaces. We will explore these themes with a variety of guests from different political backgrounds, including activists, academics, and theologians. We pray that this podcast series will help you to discern what God requires of you, to seek justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. Thanks for listening. Hello and welcome back to the SCM podcast. I'm here today with Reverend Dr. Doug Gay. Doug, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure, William.
So, Doug, you were my dissertation supervisor for my theology and religious studies course, and also you've been doing some teaching for quite a while now at Glasgow University. One of the modules that you've taken over the last few years that I've been at has been the political theology course. But before we get into talking a little bit about an introduction to political theology, do you want to tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, I think I also want to tell you, your listeners, that it's a beautiful sunny day in Glasgow, because I know that's not everyone's perception. People think it always rains here, but it's a beautiful sunny day with blue skies. About myself, well, I think, like many people, my story is relevant to my views on political theology. So I grew up in rural southwest Scotland. My dad was English and my mum was Scottish, and they moved from England just before I was born. So I'm a child of the 60s, and I grew up in a fundamentalist church called the Plymouth Brethren, the Exclusive Brethren, which was an extremely conservative church, both theologically but also sociologically, was a deeply conservative church. So we had lots of restrictions on what we were allowed to do. We had no TV or radio in the house when I was young, no record player. We weren't allowed to join the Cubs or Scouts. We weren't allowed to eat in restaurants or have school dinners, and very strict restrictions on mixing socially with people who were not part of our assembly or meeting, as it was called. And so that was a part of my story. And then, due to various changes and schisms and splits, I in my teenage years ended up in a much more kind of liberalizing environment. And I joined the Church of Scotland when I was 16 years old, left the other church. I went away to university and studied history and politics when I was 17. We do this young in Scotland sometimes after our hires. And then, and university, I suppose, that was, so I went in 1980. So I'm a child of the Thatcher years, and those were very powerful years in terms of being politicized when I was at university. I also went to a university which is a majority of English students and non-Scottish students, and many people who'd been to private schools. I'd gone to the local comprehensive, and so that was an interesting part of my journey as well. Trying to not give you the whole life story. After university, I worked briefly for the civil service. Then I worked in a youth club in inner London. Then I worked for a housing association. Then I trained for the ministry in Glasgow, for the Church of Scotland ministry. And then I went back and worked in Hackney in East London. as a pastor there for 7 years. Then I came back to do my PhD at the University of Edinburgh. And I've been working at the University of Glasgow for the last 18 years.
That's great. Thanks for sharing. So to go back to what I was saying just a minute ago about the political theology class that I took with yourself, I think one of the things that stood out for me was just the assumptions that we often have about political ideas, that we somehow know what we're talking about when we talk about things like democracy, when we talk about things like sovereignty or nationhood, that we have an idea in our heads of what that is. But then when we actually dig down a little bit deeper, things can get a little bit more complicated. So when we talk about political theology, what do we mean?
Well, that made me, with the way you introduced that, made me think of, I mean, one of the most eminent political theologians of the last 20 years, Oliver O'Donovan, I think at the beginning of his book, The Ways of Judgment, he says that people assume that that political concepts are clear and theological concepts are murky. But I think he says something like, I'm going to proceed in the assumption that the gospel is luminously simple and that political ideas are often mysterious and hard to penetrate and explain. So that's a wee bit of Oliver Donovan trying to just flip that assumption there. Political theology, there are lots of ways into this conversation. I suppose I would just come at it initially from two directions. One is that I would say it's interested in the political dimensions of theology and the church. So it starts with the assumption that there are no politically neutral forms of theology. All theology has a kind of social context, it has an ethnic context, it has a power context, it has a geographical context, an economic context. And so it's interested in the political dimensions of theology and the political identity and positioning of the church. But I think it's also interested in something else. I think it's interested in reflecting theologically on the meaning of political concepts. And so bringing the traditions and the narratives of theology and the beliefs, the doctrines, the dogma of theology into dialogue with the basic vocabulary and conceptuality of politics and political theory. And it turns out that's already a those are two conversations which are already heavily implicated in one another. So famously, the German political theologian Carl Schmitt, who was a Nazi, and his contribution to the discipline remains very controversial because of his support for the Nazi party, but he has a saying which is still widely quoted within the discipline about how many political concepts are basically, he thinks, secularized theological concepts. And so one of the things you mentioned, sovereignty, is an interesting example of that. In other words, you know, who is in charge? Is there someone in charge of the world? And alongside that, you know, legitimacy, what would make their sovereignty legitimate? And so when you begin to open it up from that kind of perspective, then you see these conversations actually have been weaving in and out of each other for millennia. The task of political theology, I think, is to do these two things. It's to reflect on the political location of theology and on the theological meaning and responsibility of politics.
Well, you mentioned there the controversial figure of Carl Schmitt, and I was thinking about a tweet thread that you'd put out today that you'd shared with me, and maybe looking at someone like Carl Schmitt and then kind of modern examples of the way that religion, when it finds its way into politics, like for example the way that we're seeing it with Trump and white evangelicals in North America currently, where would you say you lie when it comes to the question of how or why Christians should participate in politics, or should their faith influence their politics, is probably the better question. Should individuals' faith influence the way that they think about politics, the way they engage with politics? And just to take some recent examples from the Scottish Parliament, for example, we've seen a couple of different MSPs use scripture in the Scottish Parliament to justify their arguments. So what place does that have when you have on one end of the spectrum evangelicals that are Trump supporting in America using it to justify a sort of crystal fascism, and then on the other end of the spectrum people like Ross Greer from the Scottish Green Party using it as a way to justify implementing buffer zones for abortion clinics and services?
Well, it's interesting on that last narrative, actually, that I think you maybe picked the wrong example there, just because Kate Forbes and Ross Greer both voted against in favor of buffer zones outside of abortion clinics. And I think we'd probably say they both voted the way they did on the basis of their faith, although it's well known there are other differences between them. I mean, we may come back to that. It's been a fascinating week in terms of conversations about faith and public life in Scottish politics, and a lot of eyes from other places, eyes and ears fixed on Scotland, because of the kind of conversations we're having about that, many of them provoked by Kate Forbes and the controversy that she's attracted. To begin with, you know, should faith influence politics? I think it's impossible to keep faith and politics apart from one another, and I think it's wrong to try. And one of the things I said, and I did a little thread just trying to help reframe some of the conversations today, a Twitter thread, and one of the points I was making was that all mainstream Christian traditions believe and want their members to apply their faith thoughtfully to the whole of their lives. You know, I mean, if you want a text from the New Testament, you know, take every thought captive for Christ. You know, that the idea that Christian discipleship is whole life discipleship, and that all of our lives are involved in our attempts to follow Jesus and live within the reign of God. And so absolutely, that includes, you know, our artistic lives, our sexual lives, our financial lives, and our political lives. So, and one of the things that's frustrated me a little bit is that particularly on the progressive left, you know, well, you get it in two places. You get it a bit on the progressive left, and you also get it on the kind of privatized, fearful, you know, conservative right. People saying, oh, never mix religion and politics. But I think that's, you know, what kind of religion and what kind of politics, those things really matter, as you're pointing out. So if you mix bad religion and bad politics, that's a particularly toxic mix. But the way to counter it is not through some kind of false opposition. It's through, you know, as the old African-American spiritual says, have you got good religion? You know, it's good religion and good politics. That's what we need. You know, but not any kind of false separation of the two.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to bring out throughout this series, is that there's lots of different ways in which faith will influence people in their politics and in their political action. And that's not necessarily just when it comes to voting and participating in representative democracy, but it is a very important year for representative democracy. There's expected to be over 4 billion people eligible to vote this year, which is more than any other time in history. So how can theology inform our thinking on things like democracy, voting, and political engagement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I would say one of the most urgent tasks of political theology at this point in time, and there are many pressing tasks, and it's, you know, of course you have to immediately see responses to the climate crisis amongst those, but I think one of the most urgent tasks, which may be surprising, I think is a kind of defense of liberal democracy and of the importance of liberal democracy. And there are lots of layers to that. It's not a completely straightforward question, because you need to get that involved in conversations about colonialism and about the assumptions made from a Western perspective. But I'm going to stick to that and say that I think that the defense of liberal democracy is a really important task for political theology at the moment. And I suppose one of the people, you know, everybody has their intellectual heroes, and one of my intellectual heroes would be someone called Nicholas Walterstorff, who is he is a philosopher who comes from the Christian Reformed Church, which is a Dutch tradition based in Michigan. So, you know, he would have come from through Grand Rapids, where Calvin University is today, and then taught at Yale for many years. And Walterstorff has been one of my kind of mentors and somebody I'm deeply influenced by. And I really like his writing around this, you know. And one of the things he would do is he would take it right back to creation. So on the political theology course that you took, I spent a lot of time saying to people, this is about anthropology. This is about our view of the human person, our theological anthropology, and how we bring together our understanding of what it means to be human with our theology. And so Walterstorff, I think, would say there's something about the dignity of the human person, as made in the image of God, which he thinks is fundamental for the development of ideas of democracy, because and of ideas of equality within political traditions. So there's something, you know, so axiomatic, and sometimes we don't take it back right back to our anthropological assumptions, but. A key issue is that whoever you are in the society, that you matter, and your voice matters, and therefore potentially your vote matters and your rights matter. Another voice, I suppose, maybe more controversial and certainly more widely read than Walterstorff more recently, would have been Tom Holland and his book Dominion, in which he has tracked, you know, from a kind of agnostic perspective, although he seems to me to be edging closer to coming out as a Christian at some level, but he has tracked the influence of Christianity on Western thought, and basically says it's impossible to understand the basic assumptions of Western liberal society without looking at their roots within religion and the Jewish and Christian traditions in particular.
Yeah, and I also think of the writing of someone like John de Groece, the South African theologian, who's wrote a bit about democracy and how theology plays into that. And he talks about the need for creating like a wider civil society and a culture of democracy, which I think is very important and demonstrates the ways in which our faith can play a part, not just in voting once every 4 years, but actually promoting democratic principles and values beyond just the ballot box, through things like trade unions, through things like churches and religious organizations, and that they actually play a big part in, like you said, defending the idea of liberal democracy. But yeah, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean John de Groece, another of my heroes, and as somebody again who was deeply affected by the anti-apartheid movement and by its witness within Scotland, and again that was one of the things that politicized me. And I would say while I was still at school, you know, beginning to get a sense of the outrage of apartheid and the way in which. I mean, subsequently, I came to realize, it came to understand the way in which it was finally named by the Reformed churches worldwide as a heresy. And that's an interesting blurring of theological and political language. Apartheid is a heresy, and it's a heresy because it's an offense to our understanding of the image of God in other human beings, as is all racism. So, from an early period, you know, people like John de Groece, Alan Boesak, Desmond Tutu, obviously. And then Jim Wallis was another big figure for me when I was like 17, 18, the civil rights leader who formed the Sojourners community in North America. Like me, he came from an evangelical background and still identified as an evangelical. But he was someone who was deeply formed by the experience of the civil rights movement. And so, I mean, this takes us into another concept of political theology, you know, which was one of the themes of our class, which was the idea of the people. You know, who are the people? I live in Ibrox in Glasgow, and the local football team have a chant they sing at the football matches where they sing, "We are the people." Now, the problem with that is when they sing it, there's pretty strong othering of another group who they are saying basically are not the people. And so the issue is, who counts as a political subject within democracy? Who counts as a human being? And when you get to liberation theology, Gutierrez famously said that, you know, the dialogue of Western theology had been, and academic theology had been with non-belief, the ideas of non-belief. But Gutierrez said, our principal concern is to oppose the idea of the non-person, the people who have been treated as if they are not fully human within our societies, and to say, you know, that they are beloved of God, and that they are made in God's image, and they deserve rights, and they deserve all that they need to live in fullness of life.
One of the things that's already, I suppose, quite apparent is there's lots of different streams that exist within political theology that have different emphasis. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about what different strands exist within political theology. I suppose if we were to give some labels to them as to how do we designate these different types. So, for example, liberal and liberation versus feminist, and how do we talk about all of these and go beyond just a kind of general look at political theology and go more into the particular situations where theology is trying to be applied to practical situations?
Yeah, it's a great question, and a big question as well. Let me have a bit of a run at that, and I'll see where we get to. So, I mean, if you worked your way through Christian history, then something that's been quite a big theme in recent decades has been people looking at Christianity before, during, and after Christendom. So the idea that Christianity begins amongst people who have relatively little social, economic, and political power, and that the texts of the New Testament are written in that period, including one of the most important political theology texts, the Book of Revelation, which Alan Bozak and many others, Christopher Rowland, would point out has been a favored text by oppressed peoples throughout history. And So there's a pre-Christendom theology there where people are having to work out how to survive in the face of persecution, are having to work out what it means to confess Jesus as Lord and King, you know, if you like, in the same way, as Lord and God, in the same way that Caesar potentially was confessed as that within the civic religion of the Roman Empire. And then you have the church beginning to take hold of political power as it becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. And I suppose that's where you get the first kind of concern to try and see if Christianity can then influence and shape society through a responsible exercise of power. The long period of the experiment in doing that. Within that, with tradition, we then get this interesting, and here beginning to pull some things apart within the Roman Catholic tradition, where you get on the one hand the strengthening of the personal power of the Pope, and on the other push back against that as you move on into the Middle Ages in terms of what's called the conciliarist movement, where people begin to say, actually, you know, it's fine to have the Pope, but we also need to have times when we draw together broader deliberative assemblies and councils within the church. And we need to think about what their powers are up to and as far as removing a pope who may come to be seen as in some way not exercising their power properly. And do they have that? Do they have that right? Or do we imagine the church in a more hierarchical way? And so there begins to be a debate there, if you like, between those who are assuming a certain prerogative for the papacy, and in the secular realm, those who have been believing in the divine right of kings and the fact that kings are appointed by God to rule over other people, and therefore God has established a chain of being and a hierarchy, the way in which that comes to be challenged from the bottom up, if you like. So the idea that sovereignty and God's sovereignty can be exercised and displayed in ways other than just coming top down through male individuals who hold positions of power. And still today, you know, the battle for democracy, even in the issue over Trump, you know, in a sense, you can see people who want a strong leader, you know, and who are sitting very light to democracy in many ways and to the control of the people over that leader. The other thing that's just worth mentioning, and I won't go on too long, but the other thing that's worth mentioning, I suppose, is the split in political theology between those who have tended to take a more optimistic view of human nature and those who have tended to take, and human potential, and those who've tended to take a more gloomy view. And there is a sense in which political conservatism and the traditions associated with that often, and we can look back to Thomas Hobbes, you know, in the 17th century, life is nasty, brutish and short, and the war of, all against all, but that's the state of nature. So, you know, do you believe that actually people, as Nick Cave says, people, they ain't no good, and you need a political system which will somehow force them to, if not be good, to be less bad and less brutal towards one another and less murderous towards one another than they would otherwise be? Or can you appeal to the potential within people to cooperate, to build good societies, to make good laws? Can you dream of social reform? And so that kind of contrast between a more conservative movement who tend to be emphasizing human depravity and sinfulness, and those who have a more optimistic view of what is possible within human society and the ways in which we can follow the path, not just of giving away our rights to Leviathan, to the strong leader, but of together trying to form a society in which all are empowered, all have a voice, and all cooperate together to legitimize government and try to make good laws.
Yeah, so as we trace those developments and changes that occur in Christian theology and how that engages with political life, how do we end up in the position where things like liberation and feminist theology begin to emerge?
Yeah, so I think this is where, you know, the question of who is a political subject, you know, we go back to this question of who are the people, and that the Western traditions of political theology develop with this kind of normative, idealized idea of a political subject, which is often very abstract, but actually it's not that abstract. It's basically a Western, privileged, educated male, the white male, heterosexual male, you know. So as you move further into the early modern world, then you have these developing controversies. And we started on the course, I suppose, we looked at Bartolomé de las Casas in Latin America, and the way in which he begins to advocate, having, you know, from being very compromised early in his career, for the idea that the indigenous people of Latin America are people who have rights and are also made in the image of God. And some people, you know, regard him as one of the progenitors of human rights in that tradition because of that. And then a crucial, you know, what Jim Wallis calls America's original sin, but very much also Britain's original sin as well, and Scotland's original sin because of our complicity in it, the whole narrative of slavery and the dehumanization of people being treated as commodities in the transatlantic slave trade, and people who are treated as commodities subjected to extreme cruelty and inhumanity, and also crucially not seen as political subjects. You know, so the framing, all the stuff, you know, Hamilton and all that, the framing of the American Constitution and all the lofty ideas around that, many of them influenced by Protestant ecclesiology and as well, and a fusion between that and classical political thought. But the way in which these ideas are framed in against a context of exclusion of whole classes of people from being political subjects. And so, you know, in the last, you know, 200 or 300 years, the struggle has been from people to oppressed peoples to say, you know, if you have an idea of politics and of who is a political subject, which excludes us, then you have a deficient idea. And for those who have been working within the Christian tradition, again, you go back to a theology of creation. And that's the crucial point from which, You know, so, you know, Christianity is both the slaveholder's religion, which, you know, legitimizes slavery, but it also becomes a set of narratives from which oppressed African-American peoples draw to develop a theology of liberation and a demand, you know, that they are recognized as full political subjects within their political systems. Feminist theology, theology rooted in the experience of gay and lesbian people, queer traditions of political theology in the present moment, disability theology, theology which is also wanting to talk about the, in some cases, the rights of the natural world and of animals and all creatures as well. So that sense of who is given political agency, who is respected as a political subject within that process, many of the subsequent iterations of political theology, and some of those which are most potent at the moment, all return to this question of Gutierrez's question of who is going to be treated as fully human in our societies and as people who can participate in the political process.
Yeah, so as that development's occurred where more people have been brought into this understanding of being a political subject, where do you think the understanding of how the church fits into that comes in? Like, how should or how do churches view themselves as political entities in themselves, and how has that maybe developed alongside that development of the individual's political subjectivity?
Yeah, well, that's a huge question, a really fascinating question. So, again, if you go back into the New Testament, you have the idea of the church itself as being a holy nation, and the church Catholic is forming in the same way as the Ummah, you know, with some parallels to that within Islam, as a transnational community of the people of God. So there's a sense in which the church as a political entity overflows all of the cultural and geographical boundaries and locations. Is constantly reaching out. And this is one of the reasons why in recent times, to people's surprise, a number of Marxist philosophers developed a new interest in the Apostle Paul. You know, Paul, it was very fashionable to hate on Paul, you know, within progressive Christian circles. And so people were kind of amazed when these Marxist philosophers were going, you know, Paul's kind of a political genius. It took a lot of people by surprise. But it's because of his incredibly important role in thinking of the church ecumenical, the church universal, the church as this transnational community which is capable, which is crucial to the expression of a new humanity in Christ. And so the church on the one hand has this Catholic tradition, which is, I always forget this, what's the centrifugal, centripetal, what's the one that pushes out? The one that pushes out, anyway, it's kind of an extrovert understanding of ecclesiology. And then after the Reformation, then you have a kind of situation where Protestant churches and the Treaty of Westphalia and the end to the wars of religion, you get this sense of Protestant churches within national boundaries and the boundaries of emerging nation states forming these alliances with the rulers and the authorities within their own particular territory. And so that's where we, you know, which is what, something that's obviously very relevant to us within the UK, because we have this tradition of established churches. So of a compact between one form of religion and the state favoring and supporting, if you like, one strand of confessional religious identity. And clearly that's another political dimension to the church, which has a very mixed history. It tends to have been used particularly in the earlier centuries to try and wipe out those who the kind of Christians you didn't agree with and didn't want to be. So, you know, Catholic countries oppressed Protestants and Protestant countries oppressed Catholics, and both of them oppressed Anabaptists, who everybody hated on, and Anabaptists and Jews. those things are part of the church's story when you think about the political influence of the church, you know, they have to be reckoned with. But then I suppose there are other ways you can look at the church which emerges, the black church which emerges from the experience of slavery. You can look at the confessing church, which Bonhoeffer and others lead in opposition to Nazi Germany. You can look at the role of the church in the civil rights movement. You can look at the role of the church opposing apartheid. And so it's, again, it's a complicated story. It's a messy story. It's a story where there are lots of mistakes and you know, worse than mistakes, you know, absolute perversions of the gospel to be repented of in the history of the church as a political force in different contexts, hence we get, you know, we get to this situation in the modern world where there is so much controversy about the role of the church, you know, because and people, you know, the church is not always very sure how much political power and influence it wants and how it should seek to exercise that, and many people within society are equally unsure they want the churches to have any political influence at all.
I think that leads nicely into the next question, which would be, how can congregations and individual Christians discern the ways in which they can engage and act politically?
Great question. I like that question because I often say that I think churches are good places to talk about politics. I think we should embrace that more. It's interesting, actually, that many political hustings during general election campaigns take place in church premises and church halls, and the church is often seen as a kind of honest broker. People who are capable of, and sometimes more capable than anyone else in their communities still, of hosting a good political conversation, a fair political conversation. And so I think that, you know, we should value that tradition and the way in which that has worked. But I think the first step is to understand that the church is not a politically neutral, you know, and that maybe goes against what I've just said. We can be good hosts for a conversation during an election campaign, but in terms of the church's mission and its ministry day to day, the church is not called to be politically neutral. And so the church is called to be a Matthew 25 church. It's called to stand with those who have the least power and the least opportunity within society. And I would say there's a whole range of things the church is called to stand for, stand against corruption, to stand for integrity. The church is meant to prize truth-telling and truthfulness, even when that might damage our own side and our own interests. So there's a whole range of things which are, you know, to me, obvious themes within Christian discipleship, which should shape the church's political involvement locally. It's not just about food banks, although food banks may be a really important expression of that, but it's about caring for the whole process of democracy and thinking about political life and what it means to have healthy political parties in our area, and about whose voice is being heard and not being heard within local politics. And also, you know, one thing we've not really mentioned is, you know, the importance of ecology and of green politics in the contemporary world, and the ways in which the churches, I think, have been on a journey to recognize the importance of care for creation or ecological theology, however you want to put that. And so for every local church, there's a sense that what you could call a priestly dimension of the church's life, to love and to pray for the area in which they are set, the place in which they are set. Who is going to pray for this area and its people and all the creatures who live there and its landscape and its rivers and mountains, if not you who are the church there? And so all those things, I think, are part of the political responsibility and vocation of a local church.
Yeah, and I think all of that ties into like the idea of the five marks of mission that we have. Like, maybe not everywhere, but a lot of the time there is a strong conception of some of the marks, like to proclaim the good news, to teach and baptize, to respond to human need. And then those kind of other two of the to transform unjust structures and to safeguard the integrity of creation. Yeah. I think sometimes there's a bit of work that needs to be done on that. And I think part of it is that lack of confidence that the church can sometimes have of knowing where to step in. And I think we've seen it in certain situations. I think particularly of how when the Reverend Munther Isaac from Palestine came over to the UK and was doing a tour, that the Archbishop of Canterbury had refused to meet with him initially because he'd attended a pro-Palestine rally that Jeremy Corbyn had been at. And afterwards, Archbishop of Canterbury apologized for that, but yeah. He was so cautious about what to do, not wanting to be associated with the legacy of Jeremy Corbyn and whatever perception yeah. people had of him in the media. He didn't have the confidence to come out and meet with Munther Isaac publicly. And yeah. I think that lack of confidence is a big problem for the church today, and it really highlights a lot of the need for why churches should be politically engaged and the need for congregations collectively to come together and discern how they should act and how they should speak and what is going to be their witness within their communities and their locale today and how that relates to politics.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. And I think, you know, just as the eco-congregation movement in Scotland, and I don't know if you've had David Coleman on your podcast, you know, but really important champion of green theology and within that movement. But also the way in which the international awareness of the church, you know, organizations like Christian Aid and CEAF in Scotland, the Scottish Catholic International Aid Fund, Tear Fund, the ways in which those, you know, bring regularly a global dimension to people's thinking week by week in the church, and the way in which we pray for countries across the world, and the importance of prayer as a political act. There's a quote that's often attributed to Karl Barth, although nobody's ever been able to find anywhere that he said or wrote it. But it's a great quote: to clasp your hands together in prayer is the beginning of an uprising against the disorder of the world. And whoever said it, it's a great quote. I think the idea, I teach a course on prayer, a 10-week course where we look at all the different dimensions of leading public prayer. And in every session, one of the things we look at is the political significance of the kind of prayer that we're engaged in, whether it's lament or silence or praise or intercession, and that all of those have a political dimension to them. And I hope that's going to be a book shortly that will come out and we'll explore that. So absolutely. And the ways in which the church is being tested and will be judged over its response to events in Gaza just now. But also, I suppose, the question of the short attention span of Western media and how, whether within the church and our prayers and our deliberations, we can also understand that we have to stay in communion with the church in Ukraine and the church in Russia, with the church in Sudan and the Muslim community in Sudan, you know, these places which are often then forgotten and the media falls silent about them. The sense of a God who is God of all the world, who is constantly reaching out in love to the world. The horror of what's been happening in Gaza, and the church, like some other parts of society, trying to work out how to integrate the learning it has tried to do about anti-Semitism with the learning it's tried to do about the injustice of the occupation of Palestinian lands and the oppression of Palestinian people. And that's obviously something we're still very much in the middle of at the moment. You know, and particularly in America, you know, you can see within conservative circles how it's very influenced by readings of prophecy and apocalyptic and understandings of the place of Israel within, you know, God's sovereign plan for the world. So, you know, huge contemporary challenges there.
Well, let's just end with, do you want to share at all any recent publications or work that you would like people to know about? And if people are interested in staying connected with you, if you would like to share it, then where can they find you on social media and online?
Okay, the last major thing I suppose I wrote within political theology was just before the 20, it was 10 years ago. I wrote a book called Honey from the Lion, Christianity and the Ethics of Nationalism, which was, I'm a member of the SNP, and so that was an exploration of the ethics of nationalism and a qualified theological defense of what I call a discipled form of nationalism. So if people are interested in those themes, that's an SCM Press book, which came out in 2014. In terms of finding me on social media, the place I do most of my political theology thinking is on Twitter. There are some threads there that you'll find most often about Scottish politics and about relationships between faith and theology. In Scottish politics, and regular denunciations of the House of Lords, which is one of my Twitter themes. So, if you want to hear any of that stuff, you can find me there. And if anybody wanted to get in touch about anything, my address is on the University of Glasgow website under Theology and Religious Studies. I'm happy for anyone to be in touch.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us on the SCM podcast. As always, you can find us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Student Christian Movement, or on X at SCM_Britain. Every episode of Season 3 comes with an accompanying blog, looking more in depth at the topics discussed. These come out every Monday after the podcast is released. So check out the latest blog on our website at movement.org.uk, and thanks for listening.